buddy. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. This is a day to celebrate human rights. I'm pretty sure I have mixed emotions about this, but this day ends Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which means that folks who want to serve the United States military may do so regardless of their sexual orientation. The reason I say it's a good day for human rights, I don't know why, and I honestly don't. Maybe, and don't send me an email. I was going to say maybe somebody who wants to send me an email explain this to me, but don't, because I know what kind of email I'll get. But I don't know why someone would want to serve in the military in these times when the military is so misused. But having said that, let me also say that it is a day of liberation for people who do want to serve the United States military and have been forced to live a lie or keep their orientation completely quiet. So in that regard, it is a day to celebrate for human rights, civil rights. Kate Petrini writes, Mike, don't know if you caught Rachel's show last night with her guest Michael Moore. Last week, you were discussing the relatively abysmal turnouts at protests like the one on Wall Street, 1,600 people. Moore pointed out that 1,600 or 1,200 or even a couple hundred people would have been more than enough for the media to descend on Lower Manhattan had the protesters been teabaggers. And he is absolutely correct. Thousands of anti-war protesters were barely a blip on the radar screen of most American media outlets. But a few teabaggers, alert the press! The only TV coverage I saw about the Wall Street protesters was on CNN. And the anchor used a rather snarky tone as he was talking with the on-the-scene reporter. No surprise there, I suppose. What a sorry-ass excuse for journalism we have in this country. Okay. Yeah, that is so true. And speaking of that, at least five protesters were reportedly arrested earlier today in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan after police forced demonstrators to remove tarps that were protecting electronic equipment from the rain. You know, how God, I wish I was only on Sirius or XM. I could finish that sentence. Let me rephrase it. How crappy is that? To make demonstrators remove a tarp that was protecting electronic equipment. You miserable bastards. These people are out there in Lower Manhattan protesting indirectly on behalf of police officers, firefighters, school teachers, so-called public employees that Wall Street wants to destroy. And it's one thing for the cops to have to enforce the law. It's something else, again, to say, remove the tarp! Jesus. Occupy Wall Street, a group not affiliated with Adbusters or Anonymous, claims there were injuries as well, one of them critical. Let me see what else. Alan Eaton, who has camped in the park since Saturday, tells this blog site, I don't have the name of the blog site here, I apologize, tells us that NYPD officers demanded the removal of the tarps at around 10:30 a.m. because they acted as tents. Oh my God, people were getting under them. Not allowed to do that, right? When they weren't removed fast enough, things got tough. Eaton saw one man being dragged away in cuffs and he was bleeding out of his mouth. Another protester reportedly had an asthma attack while he's being arrested, and the video at this page illustrates him struggling under the weight of the arresting officer. I think we have that video up, don't we, Kathy? Yeah, you can go to MikeMalloy.com. I think you can see the whole video. Thousands have gathered in the financial district since the demonstration began on Saturday. At least seven have been arrested before today, some for violating an antiquated anti-mask law, others for illegal entry or jumping a barricade. Alan Eaton, the one who is doing some of this reporting, said, most of the police I've talked to have been very supportive, but there have been a few that were really rude. This is a peaceful protest. Anyway, more updates. You know the websites to go to for video updates, blogging updates, and so on and so forth. A complete and total blackout, media blackout. Speaking of CNN, Ari Fleischer is, I'm sorry, CNN is identifying itself with the hiring of Ari Fleischer as another corrupt right-wing network. I can't imagine what Ted Turner's thinking about all this. He has officially, Ari Fleischer, Ari the Liar, has officially joined CNN as a political contributor. That was announced today. He has been contributing to CNN semi-regularly anyway. He was one of the panelists during CNN's 9/11 memorial coverage earlier this month. Can you imagine that? Allowing some rat bastard like Ari Fleischer to be a commentator on the CNN's 9/11 memorial coverage. CNN is just become a suckhole of right-wing proto-fascists anyway. They're almost as bad as Fox now, except for the fact that the people on CNN are still a hell of a lot smarter. Any one person on CNN is smarter than any 20 people on Fox. God, that sounds like a schoolyard taunt, doesn't it? My team's smarter than your team. It's not my team anymore. But anyway, I digress. CNN political director Sam Feist called Fleischer's experience, quote, invaluable as the network heads into the 2012 election cycle. Really, kind of like George Bush's cousin was invaluable over at Fox during the 2000 election, huh? CNN is just, it's just in the toilet. You want to, here's some quotes from Ari Fleischer when he was press secretary. These are all Ari. Well, there's no question that we have evidence and information that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical particularly, and this will be made clear in the course of the operation for whatever duration it takes. It's March 21st, 2003. In December 2002, if he declares he has none, then we will know that Saddam Hussein is once again misleading the world. January 2003, we know for a fact there are weapons there. March 21st, 2003, well, there is no question that we have evidence and information that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical particularly. I already did this one. April 10th, 2003, I think you have always heard and you will continue to hear from officials a measure of high confidence that indeed the weapons of mass destruction will be found. Ari Fleischer is a liar. He has always been a liar. He will always be a liar. It makes perfect sense then for CNN to hire him. Astonishing. Just astonishing. Troy Davis has lost what appeared to be his last attempt to avoid death by lethal injection by 7 p.m. tomorrow evening here in Georgia. The Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles made it very clear this morning that no matter what evidence is presented, these murderous sons of bitches are going to carry out the death sentence anyway. Even when you have right-wingers, left-wingers, so-called religious figures, ex-president, and close to a million signatories on petitions. But this is Georgia. The Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles is an elected position. And the way you get elected to that position is to declare that there will be nobody freed, nobody's sentence commuted, while by God, you are on the board.
Where does summer go? Bend down, Congress, kneel down and lend a hand. Tell the people liberty must go. There's more to gain in war than peace. Let weapons flow, destabilize the Middle East, enrich the CEO. Lie down, people, Bill of Rights. Here's Mikey.
21 past the hour. Davis, Troy Davis was convicted of murder in 1991. Murder of an off-duty Savannah police officer. The murder occurred in 1989. He was convicted despite a lack of physical evidence. No murder weapon was ever found, nor was any DNA evidence linking Davis to the crime. And as you know by now, a majority of the eyewitnesses who testified in Davis's initial trial have since recanted their testimony under sworn affidavits. Davis has steadfastly claimed throughout the years that he was wrongfully convicted. And the courts here in Georgia say, and the Supreme Court say, they have given Davis ample time to prove his point. You see, if you're a black person in Georgia and you're convicted of murdering a white person, then you will be given opportunity, or if you're charged with killing a white person, you'll be given opportunity, usually with a public defender, to prove your innocence. But wait, Mike, you're supposed to be innocent until you're proven guilty. Oh, please, come on. Come on. it's nothing to giggle about. The widow of the police officer who was, there is no question that he was murdered in a Savannah parking lot that night in 1989. The question is, who is guilty? It's astonishing the number of people who have pleaded with the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles to grant this man clemency, and they have steadfastly refused. What's his name with the Innocence Project? I forget his name. He said that in this case, in this particular case, the chances are very good that an innocent man will be murdered by the state of Georgia tomorrow night. I can understand the family's grief. The family says, or his widow said, he has had ample time to prove his innocence, and he is not innocent. We have laws in this land so that there is not chaos. We are not killing Troy because we want to. We're trying to execute him because he was punished. A law professor at Georgia State here in the Atlanta area, university, says there are not any other avenues to pursue. She is a law professor at Georgia State who has formally reviewed the case and found it too weak to merit the death penalty. She said there's nothing else apparent that can be done here. William Sessions, former FBI director, has asked for clemency in this case. Bob Barr, right-wing maniac and former federal prosecutor, former member of Congress, has asked for clemency in this case. Desmond Tutu, President Jimmy Carter, members of Congress, I think 50 members of Congress, have asked for clemency in this case. But it appears that the execution of Troy Davis, regardless of the fact that there is ample room for reasonable doubt, the burden of proof is to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. When you have no physical evidence, no DNA evidence, no murder weapon, and the recanting of the testimony of 7 of 9 people, then do you not have reasonable doubt? I mean, the state of Georgia can execute him any time it pleases, given the proper death warrant. So, and it's been 20 years since he was convicted and sentenced to death. So another week, another month, another year, while people work on his behalf to secure a new trial for him. No, not in Georgia, not in Texas, not in so many of the states of the old Confederacy. This is a black man. The victim was a white man. And it has been shown time and time and time again in this country, especially in the South, but the entire country, a far greater value is placed on white life than on black life. If you kill a white person, no matter your race, the odds of your being executed are much greater, several times greater, than if the person killed is a black person, no matter the race of the perpetrator. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malone.
Pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of Father, maybe, but not in my name. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster.
Your nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. We'll talk a little bit more about the Troy Davis horror a little bit later this evening. I guess you've heard about this. Have you not heard about it? Tony Bennett was on Howard Stern's program on Sirius XM yesterday. Apparently he's out on a record tour. Yeah, they still do that. And Tony Bennett, who is, what, 81, 82 years old now, he told Howard Stern that when he was being honored, when Bennett was being honored at the Kennedy Center in 2005, then President Bush said to Bennett that, quote, he made a mistake about the Iraq War, end quote. That's what Tony Bennett told Howard Stern. And as soon as that was said, Howard Stern and Tony Bennett got into a discussion about the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Stern said, quote, you gotta eliminate war, but what do you do with these terrorists who blew up the World Trade Center? Tony Bennett replied, who are the terrorists? Are we the terrorists or are they the terrorists? Two wrongs don't make a right. And then Tony Bennett continued that he wasn't on board with the statement that those who attacked started the conflict. Bennett said, quote, they flew the plane in, but we caused it. We were bombing them, and they told us to stop. Later on in this conversation, Bennett added that he believed, quote, to start a war in Iraq was a tremendous, tremendous mistake internationally, end quote. Yeah, he's out on tour to promote his new album, Duets 2, and he has since posted a statement, I guess at his website or someplace, to clarify the comments he made on Stern's show and to apologize if they were misconstrued. He's 85. He said in the statement, quote, I'm so grateful to be an American And as a World War II veteran, I was proud to fight to protect our values, which have made America the greatest country on the planet. They always have to do this, don't they? And then he went on to say, there is simply no excuse for terrorism and the murder of the nearly 3,000 victims of the 9/11 attacks on our country. My life experiences, ranging from the Battle of the Bulge to marching with Martin Luther King, made me a lifelong humanist and pacifist and reinforced my beliefs that violence begets violence and that war is the lowest form of human behavior. I am sorry if my statement suggested anything other than an expression of my love for my country, my hope for humanity, and my desire for peace throughout the world, end quote. Well, at least you didn't retract it, Mr. Bennett. Thank you for that. But his statement, quote, they flew the plane in, but we caused it. We were bombing them, and they told us to stop, end quote. I think on Friday, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, will petition the United Nations Security Council for membership in the United Nations for the Palestinians to have membership, the state of Palestine. Have you been following this? Abbas's plan, it was made public in a television address, according to all sorts of published reports, follows months of failed American and European efforts to restart Palestinian negotiations with Israel. And that is a direct fault of Benjamin Netanyahu, the right-wing, ultra-right-wing, fascist prime minister, Likudnik, in Israel. Now, there's a fear that Abbas's move will raise expectations among the Palestinians, with nothing changing for them on the ground, and combined with alarmed reactions from the Israelis, especially the settlers, so-called. They are not settlers, they are occupiers, that violent showdowns could erupt. The Palestinians say that after decades of occupation and 20 years of failed talks, remember the Oslo Accords, where meetings between the Palestinians and the Israelis were to take place to finally work something out? 20 years ago. The Palestinians say that after decades of occupation and 20 years of failed talks with an increasingly hawkish and belligerent Israel, it's time for a new approach in which the borders of a Palestinian state are first recognized globally, and then two states, Israel and Palestine, negotiate final details. Now, obviously, this would put the Palestinians on an equal footing with the Israelis, since it would be state to state, two UN member nations talking to each other about their borders. And I like the way the Times puts it. Listen to this sentence. The decision to apply for membership through the Security Council signals a double defeat for the United States. Ain't that a bitch? A double defeat for the United States. Hello? It is about the Palestinians, isn't it? Well, you know what the writer meant. The Obama administration not only failed to talk the Palestinians out of this bid for statehood, and why would they want to do that? You know, the Obama administration, up to and including the president himself, have been praising the Arab Spring, so-called, right? Yeah, rebellion, revolt, throw off those tyrant sons of bitches. Yeah, amen, amen. Although in certain areas we stay out of it, like Qatar and where else have we stayed out of? So far, Syria. But when you start talking about freedom, you either are talking about freedom. When you start talking about throwing off the yoke of oppression, you can't say, okay, you can throw off your yoke. Not you! Okay, you want to throw off your yoke of oppression? Okay, you're going to have to wait 70 years. Okay, sit down. Be quiet. Now, you over here, you want to throw off your yoke of oppression? Uh-huh. So the U.S. has is being told, more or less, to piss off. You know, you had your chance, United States, and what have you done? What has any of your presidents done to try to make this happen? What has your media done? What has your legislative branch done? Nothing except piss all over the Palestinian people. Treat them like scum. To the point where any time the Israelis attack, with no so-called, I hate this term, proportional response. You know, the Palestinians pick up rocks and start throwing them. The Israelis respond with fighter jets. Anytime that occurs, this filthy Congress of ours immediately, before the bombing is even stopped, write up and pass, usually by unanimous consent, if that's the right term, a declaration of support for Israel, even though Israel is the occupier. Israel has done to the Palestinians what the Nazis did in the Warsaw Ghetto. Exactly the same thing. The trains haven't started running yet, no. But that's about the only thing that's left. The Obama administration has vowed to veto any attempt in the Security Council for the Palestinians to get full recognition as a state. And as the Times says, for the Obama administration, the move poses an acute dilemma, this move by the Palestinians. The U.S. has vowed to use its veto because it argues that the only viable way toward Palestinian statehood is through direct talks with Israel. Yeah, that looks good, doesn't it? Except for the fact that the Israelis won't talk. They simply will not. So, the way it will work, admission to the UN as a full member state requires a recommendation from the 15-member Security Council with a majority of 9 votes. You have to have a majority of 9 votes and no veto from the 5 permanent members, of which the United States is one of the permanent members, and we have vowed to veto this attempt by Palestine to become a state and then start their negotiations with the state of Israel. The state of Palestine, the state of Israel. Not going to happen, the U.S. says. Then, after the Security Council, if they do give the 9 votes and the United States sits down and shuts the hell up, then the submission goes to the General Assembly, which has to pass it by 2/3 vote among its 193 members. But the Obama administration has made it very clear. Oh, no, 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 no. When we talk about a peaceful resolution in the Middle East, we don't mean like this. Oh, my God. Not this. We'll be right back. You just grab your partner by the hell, throw her down and leave her down. Well, they put Jesus on a cross, they put a hole in JFK, they put Hillary in the driver's seat. Look the other way, now they got poison in the water and the whole world in a trance. But just because we're hypnotized, that don't mean we can't dance. We got the funk, yeah. The funky Western civilization. So, so very soft and
truth seekers, Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. If you do a little research, you find out that the original two-state solution in the Middle East that was designed to establish separate countries for Jews and Arabs back in the 40s anticipated the day that both would seek United Nations membership. And a paragraph in the General Assembly Resolution 181, which established the Jewish state, This is from November 1947, said, quote, when the independence of either the Arab or the Jewish state as envisioned in this plan has become effective, then sympathetic consideration should be given to the application. Now, this was just prior. I'm sorry. The Jewish state did not come into existence until 1948. This was the Resolution 181 that set the stage for both groups to form a state. And this, of course, was the madness that the subsequent to World War II, and that allowed this situation to develop from the get-go. So anyway, Israel became a member of the UN in 1949, and the Palestinians announced their intention to submit an application, I think this Friday, which sets the stage for a fairly dramatic gathering in New York. And the Palestinians see the membership application as a last-ditch attempt to preserve the idea of a two-state solution that the United Nations tried to implement all those years ago. And the Palestinians see this this attempt as a last-ditch attempt in the face of what they refer to as ever-encroaching Israeli settlements, which is true. I mean, I say what they refer to, not to weasel out of making the statement myself, but I'm quoting something here, so I'll go with the quote. Anyway, on the part of the Palestinians, it's a move to try to shake up the negotiations that they feel have achieved nothing. After 20 years of American oversight, nothing. And it's even longer than that. It goes all the way back to Jimmy Carter, Anwar Sadat, and Menachem Begin, when the accords were reached between Egypt and Israel. And those remained in place, in effect. But Begin had to deal with the head of state, another UN member. So there may be some risk here with the Palestinians making this move, but after all these years, decades, and now 20 years of the United States playing some kind of a game, actually with both sides, with the Israelis as well as the Palestinians, but being merciless, the United States has been merciless in its treatment of the Palestinians, no matter what happened. Oh, every once in a while you see an editorial in the New York Times, or the Washington Post, or the LA Times. The Israelis shouldn't have killed 1,000 Palestinians in retaliation for the death of 1,000 Gazans in retaliation for the deaths of 9 Jewish settlers in Gaza. But on the other hand, the Palestinians have shown a reluctance to sit down at the table. You always see it this way. Have you ever seen? Okay, there are some exceptions, of course. In mainstream American media, a report on the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians that was not heavily weighted, if not exclusively weighted, toward the Israelis. If you have, send me a link. I'd love to see it. And you go back 20 years if you want to. Go back to the first Intifada in the mid-80s. Just send me something if you have a link that is totally even-handed in its criticism of both sides. You will not find it. Now, supporters of all this say it's time to shift the negotiations out of the U.S. State Department basement into the glare of an international forum. The Arab Awakening, it says here, captured global attention. Supporters believe it's the right moment to hook the Palestinian quest for ending Israeli occupation to the trend of toppling authoritarian rule throughout the Middle East. The Palestinians have two main options at the United Nations, seeking either full membership through the Security Council, which is what Mahmoud Abbas says they're going to do, or enhanced observer status in the General Assembly. And Abbas said he would go the Security Council route. And, of course, the Obama administration says, no, we're going to veto that. Now, you can imagine these scum-sucking, filthy, dirt-eating Republicans were out there today criticizing Obama. that Obama has impeded the chances of peace by what did this half-ass from Texas, Governor Perry, say? He said today, simply put, we would not be here today at the very precipice of such a dangerous move if the Obama policy in the Middle East wasn't naive, arrogant, misguided, and dangerous. That's Rick Perry. That son of a bitch couldn't find the Middle East. You give him a map and say, show us the Middle East, Rick. He'd probably point to Japan or someplace, or, I don't know, Ecuador. These half-wits. We'll be right back.
Protection.
The hour. Now, regarding gathering in New York at the United Nations General Assembly and the craziness that is about to ensue, not the appeal by the Palestinians for statehood and recognition of statehood that will be taken to the Security Council. We pretty much know the outcome of that because the Obama administration, that would be Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama, have made it very clear that they will continue to urinate all over the Palestinian people, regardless of their claims of wanting peace and justice and so on and so forth in the Middle East. No, they don't. No, they don't. Not if it means that their client state, Israel, has to give back the territory that the settlers have settled on, even though there is a huge number of Israelis who say that the settlements, as they're called, and the settlers are out of their minds. They have no business, no right to be there. But we're not talking about rights here. We're talking about what is happening to the Palestinians. The same thing prior to the trains running in Germany, the same thing that happened to the Jews. The confiscation of their property, the burning of their businesses, the destruction of their villages, and the treatment of the Jews in Germany in the 30s parallels the treatment of the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis for the past 20 or 30 years, for sure. And beyond that, if you have taken the time to to study even a little bit of the Middle East. Now, I know I'm going to get the usual tidal wave of crap that I get whenever I bring this topic up. I really don't care. I have an algorithm now that looks for certain keywords in the email you send me, and if they're there, it gets trashed. So send what you want. I really don't care. But anyway, Rick Perry was in New York today, and doing what so many political candidates do, going after the Jewish vote. There's not a Jew in New York who sees Rick Perry as anything but a clown. Just a goddamn clown. A halfwit. A moron. A schmuck. But there they were. There they were. Conservative Jewish leaders from the United States and Israel. Now, this is as Obama was attending meetings at the UN elsewhere in the city. And there stands this punk Perry, this halfwit, that no self-respecting New York Jew or Israeli Jew would spend 5 minutes with because he's such a bumpkin, halfwit, ignorant individual. But there they were. Go figure. So Perry said, quote, simply put, we would not be here today at the very precipice of such a dangerous move, statehood for the Palestinians, if the Obama policy in the Middle East wasn't naive, arrogant, misguided, and dangerous. you snotty little punk. I wish somebody would have stepped out of the crowd and say, hey, look, Rick, give us a quick 60-second history of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Go ahead. 3, 2, 1, go! Yeah, that's what you would have gotten. Silence. And then Perry went on, quote, the Obama policy of moral equivalency, which gives equal standing to the grievances of Israelis and Palestinians, including the orchestrators of terrorism, is a very dangerous insult, end quote. The orchestrators of terrorism. Somebody should ask Rick Perry, what's the definition of terrorism? Is it indiscriminate bombings of a civilian population? Is it disproportionate response when a border skirmish, let's call it that, breaks out? Is it the slaughter? Is it running a bulldozer over Rachel Corrie? I mean, what is it, Rick? You half-witted moron. He goes on. He accuses the Obama administration of encouraging the Palestinians to abandon direct talks with Israel. Which, if ever there was a stinking, filthy lie to come out of this punk's mouth that would compare with that, I don't know what it would be. He says the Obama administration encouraged the Palestinians to abandon direct talks with Israel, quote, in a policy of appeasement, end quote. You see what, I've said it before, any Republican politician, anytime the sons of bitches open their mouths, they're lying. But when I saw that video today with Israeli Jews and New York Jews standing shoulder to shoulder with this moron. What is up with you people, huh? You people being the group that was standing behind Rick Perry. What was that about? The Palestinians have said they will resume talks only after Israel stops building settlements on disputed land. That's the policy of appeasement that this cracker moron from Texas is talking about. God. Oh, Mitt Romney jumped in on it, too. This slimy bastard. Romney's really starting to irritate me. He is trying to out Bachman and out Perry, these two neo-Nazis. Romney also blamed Obama for the Palestinian bid for recognition at the UN, even though you can see it in the original UN Resolution 181, where the United Nations said, when the time comes that both sides apply for statehood, both sides should be given a real close personal consideration. But these Republicans, they are filth. They are filth. Absolute filth. I don't care what the issue is. They're ignorant, religion-besotted filth. So here's Romney. Quote, What we are watching unfold at the United Nations is an unmitigated diplomatic disaster. It is the culmination of President Obama's repeated efforts over 3 years to throw Israel under the bus and undermine Israel's negotiating position, end quote, Mitt Romney. You ass. You complete jerk. But you see, Romney has got to out-idiot Rick Perry, because Rick Perry is the leading Republican contender. But I saw those pictures today, and the videos and the stills, and I thought, you know, how can, of all people on earth, Israeli Jews, whose it's their blood that shed when these horrors of living in the Middle East explode. It's not the New York Jews. It's the Israeli Jews. But there they are. The Israeli Jews and New York Jews clustered around this moronic Rick Perry. And all of them keeping a straight face while Perry, I don't know, somebody handed to her, here, read this. Unbelievable. And Perry didn't stop there. Where is it here? Oh, yeah. Perry noted that he's made several visits to Israel. Woo! And that as a Christian, he has, quote, a clear directive to support Israel. A clear directive to support Israel. That's right. Until the rapture. Right, Rick? Come on, be honest. Come on, Rick. You support Israel until your Jesus comes back. And once your Jesus comes back, then you know that every Jew on earth will be given about 10 minutes to accept the Christian Messiah. And if they don't, Rick, you know what your job is. Pick up the nearest weapon and murder the nearest Jew. You know that. And so did the Jews. What are you people doing? Why do members of the Jewish faith hang out with these psychotic Christians who will cut their throats in an instant once they get from the Jews what they want? A huge bloody slide for their Messiah to come back.
Yeah, we got freedom of religion. I reckon that means that we must tolerate the atheist and Jew. But Jesus is the man and our salvation. And every war we wage is in his name. We think his Bible should be taught in every nation. And we'll bomb anyone who doesn't feel the same. Welcome to Jesus' land, where we all love thy neighbor if thy neighbors understand. We won't let too many Mexicans across the Rio Grande. Welcome to Jesus' land.
Radio matters here.
21 past the hour. So Rick Perry is in New York undermining U.S. foreign policy, such as it is. But his statements, as he's surrounded by Israeli and New York Jews, was just, pandering. You know, Perry knows he's pandering. Perry knows what his religion tells him about the Jews. They murdered Jesus. They had 6 million killed by Hitler because God now hates them, and the Jews are nothing more than the key to the kingdom for the Christians. And if the Jews want to come along by doing exactly what they were told to do in the Inquisition, and that is give up your Judaism or die, Perry knows this. Perry knows this. And the part that is galling to me is so do the people who are surrounding him today. Shame on you people. Shame on you. Shame on you for pandering to him while he panders to you. Shame. Perry also laid out five principles the U.S. should make clear before the U.N. This is the governor of Texas, this uneducated half-wit. Here are his five principles. That the U.S. stands with Israel and the principle of direct negotiations without equivocation laid out in the Oslo Accords of 1993. Somebody should ask him what the Oslo Accord, what does it mean? What does the word Oslo mean? What does that mean? Is that Hebrew, Rick? Number two, that a declaration of Palestinian statehood could jeopardize U.S. funding of U.N. operations. Oh, here we go with that again. This bullying son of a bitch, this typical white Caucasian right-wing Texas punk. Well, I'll tell you what, you don't do what we say, we'll just take the money away. Three, that the move on statehood jeopardizes U.S. aid to the Palestinians. How about that? You people seek your independence. If you seek your own sovereignty, we will cut off money to you. You know why? Because we are hypocritical capitalists, lying sons of bitches. That's why. Four, that the U.S. should close the Palestinian Liberation Organization office in Washington if the U.N. grants Palestinian statehood. Oh, that's nice. That's nice, Rick. And last, that the U.S. must signal to the world, including Turkey and Egypt, that the U.S., quote, won't tolerate aggression against Israel, end quote. Oh, we're supposed to signal that. We're supposed to signal that. 50 years of one-sided policy, and this dumb bastard for Texas says, well, we got to signal what we've been doing overtly and blatantly for 50 years. Go ahead. Go ahead, America. Elect this guy. Make this guy president. Go ahead. Dear colleague, this is a letter that went out to a bunch of folks. The recipients, the list of recipients is not going to be revealed. But I want you to hear the letter. Dear colleague, we write to you in light of recent deteriorating events in Washington, D.C. Misguided negotiations by the Obama administration over increasing the debt ceiling willingly put our nation's vital social services on the chopping block, while Bush-era tax cuts remain untouched. Clearly, the situation has reached crisis proportions. In response, an innovative plan has been developed to reintroduce a progressive agenda back into the political discussion during the 2012 election season. Consider for a moment two very different scenarios for the 2012 Democratic presidential primaries. Here's the first scenario. President Obama advances without contest to a unanimous nomination. There is no recognizable Democratic challenger, no meaningful debate on key progressive issues or past broken promises, just a seamless, self-contained operation on its way to raising $1 billion in campaign funds. This scenario is what most observers expect. Mr. Obama will face neither opposition nor debate. He will have no need to clarify or defend his own policies or address the promises, kept and unkept, of his 2008 campaign. The president will not have to explain to his supporters why he directly escalated the war in Afghanistan and broadened America's covert war in Pakistan, why he chose to engage in a military intervention in Libya, or why he has maintained the Bush administration's national security apparatus that allows for the suspension and abuse of constitutionally protected civil liberties, dismissing Congress all the way. There's more here. This is a letter to dear colleague, and I'll share the rest of it with you when we come back. Stay with us. 25 before the hour. Continuing this letter written to a list of people whose names will not be revealed. It's a letter to dear colleague. And the writer is laying out two scenarios. The first scenario is that President Obama advances without contest to a unanimous nomination for a second term. The writer goes on, in an uncontested Democratic primary, President Obama will never have to justify his decision to bail out Wall Street's most profitable firms while failing to push for effective prosecution of the criminal behavior that triggered the recession, or his failure to push for real financial reform. He will not have to defend his decision to extend the Bush-era tax cuts, nor justify his acquiescence to Republican extortion during the debt ceiling negotiations. He will not have to answer questions on how his administration completely failed to protect homeowners losing their homes to predatory banks, or even mention the word poverty, as he failed to do in his most recent State of the Union address, even as more and more Americans sink into financial despair. He will never be challenged to fulfill his pledge to actively pursue a labor-supporting card check, or his promise to increase the federal minimum wage, or why he took single payer off the table after he said he believed in it. The American labor movement, facing an unprecedented onslaught by the right, will not have the opportunity to voice its concerns and rally around a supportive candidate. The president will not be pressed to answer how he spent 4 years in office without addressing the ongoing destabilization of our climate, or advocating a coherent and ecologically sound energy policy, including defending his position on nuclear power and so-called clean coal. Nor will he discuss regulatory agency deficiencies in enforcing corporate law and order in an era marked by a corporate crime wave having devastating economic consequences on workers and taxpayers and their savings and pensions. There will be no opportunity for the Hispanic and other relevant communities to speak out on immigration reform, even as the Republicans continue to use it as a weapon of political demagoguery. Add your own concerns, disappointments, and frustrated hopes to this list of what will surely be left off the table during an express lane primary. The valid disagreements within the Democratic Party, let alone the goals of progressives, will be completely overlooked. The media will gleefully cover the media circus that is sure to be the Republican primaries, magnifying every minor gaffe and carefully cataloging every iteration and argument of the radical right. The cameras will cover the Democratic side only for orchestrated events, the whiff of scandal, and to offer commentary on how the campaign is positioning itself for the general election. The summation of this process will be a tediously scripted national convention, deprived of robust exchange and well-wrought policy. And here the danger is clear. Not only will progressive principles past and present be betrayed, but large sections of voters will feel bored with and alienated from the Democratic candidate. This would not serve the president's campaign, our goals, or the nation's needs. Thankfully, there is another option. The second scenario would allow for robust and exciting discussion and debate during the primary season, while posing little risk to the president other than to encourage him to take more progressive stands. It would also accomplish the critical task of energizing the progressive base to turn out on Election Day. Imagine a slate of six candidates announces its decision to run in the Democratic primaries. Each of the candidates is recognizable, articulate, and a person of acknowledged achievement. These contenders would each represent a field in which Obama has never clearly staked a progressive claim, or where he has drifted toward the corporatist right. These fields would include labor, poverty, military and foreign policy, health insurance and care, the environment, financial regulation, civil and political rights and empowerment, and consumer protection. Without primary challengers, President Obama will never have to seriously articulate or defend his belief to his own party. Given the dangers our nation faces, that option is unacceptable. The slate of six candidates is the best method for challenging the president for a number of reasons. First, the slate can indicate that its intention is not to defeat the president, a credible assertion given their number of voting columns, but to rigorously debate his policy stands. 2. The slate will collectively give voice to the fundamental principles and agendas that represent the soul of the Democratic Party, which has increasingly been deeply tarnished by corporate influence. 3. The slate will force Mr. Obama to pay attention to many more issues affecting many more Americans. He will be compelled to develop powerful, organic, and fresh language, as opposed to stale, poll-driven themes. 4. The slate will exercise a pull on Obama toward his liberal progressive base and leave that base with a feeling of positive empowerment. 5. The slate will excite the Democratic Party faithful and essential small-scale donors who are essentially liberal and progressive. 7. A slate that is serious, experienced, and well-versed in policy will display a sobering contrast with the alarmingly weak, hysterical, and untested field taking shape on the right. 7. The slate will command more media attention for the Democratic primaries and the positive progressive discussions within the party, as opposed to what will certainly be an increasingly extremist display on the right. And 8. The slate makes it more difficult for party professionals to induce challengers to drop out of the race, and more difficult for Mr. Obama to refuse or sidestep debates in early primaries. This slate, if announced, will receive free legal advice and adequate contributions for all prudent expenses in moving about the country. The paperwork is far simpler than what confronts ballot access blocked third party and independent candidates. But the slate will be composed of registered Democrats campaigning inside the party primaries. This opportunity to revive and restore the progressive infrastructure of the Democratic Party must not be missed. A slate of Democratic candidates challenging the president's substance and record is an historic opportunity. Certainly, President Obama will not be pleased to face a list of primary challengers, but the comfort of the incumbent is far less important than the vitality and strength of his party's progressive ideas and ideals. President Obama should emerge from the primary a stronger candidate as a result. Thank you, Ralph Nader. And there's some more here. You can find this if you go to, just look around. Look for Ralph Nader, or look for Nader of Progressive Candidates, and you'll find it. But this is such a good idea, because we've been talking about this on this program. How does somebody get ballot access in this country to run on a third-party platform? You simply won't. So what happens, as Nader points out, if there is no challenge from the left to Obama, then whether or not he wins does become more or less incidental to the fact that the country goes straight to the right. Obama can't succeed himself twice. So even if he wins this time, what happens next time? With a challenge from the left, where Obama is forced, hasn't he said, hold my feet to the fire? Here it is, where he is forced to debate these issues. Why did you do this? Why didn't you do that? What are you going to do about this if you're given a second term? Now, this should also placate the Obama diehards on what's the left of the left, so-called liberals, who absolutely refuse to criticize this president. You know who I'm talking about. People on the left who are in media. Or people who say they're on the left. They're not really. But liberals who are in media. This will give them cover. Because I feel in my heart that most liberals who are supporting Obama right now, who continue to support him unequivocally, are doing so knowing they can't face themselves in the mirror when their program is over. Because they know what's going on. These liberal pundits on radio and television are not stupid. None of them are stupid. They know what they're doing. And when you hear people on the left start shrieking and screaming about, Malloy, how can you do that? What about the Supreme Court? Okay, what about the Supreme Court? So here's a chance. I think Nader, and once again, Nader comes up with an exquisite idea that is more or less in keeping with what Obama told his base to do. Hold my feet to the fire. Now, how do you do that? Well, this is the way you do it. This letter went out to a group of people who could fulfill Nader's definition of a slate of liberal slash progressive candidates who would operate within the Democratic Party. They don't have to be. Yeah. This is not about ballot access. This is about candidates. There is no ballot anywhere right now. Not on the left. Not on the right. There is no ballot. So this is about debates. This is about candidates on the Democratic left saying, okay, I'm going to run for president. These are established names that this letter apparently went through. People that everyone knows, especially media. People who will take this seriously and will declare themselves. Now, if Obama doesn't participate, what's going to happen? There are going to be six candidates on a stage and Obama's missing? That's a good way to be defeated. This, I think, is an excellent idea.
I lean on in the loop to help them unremember. I was flying on UA-93. That shadow in the footage, it was probably me. I'm the rumor, I'm the doubt, I'm the lie. But you wouldn't stand.
Bang, 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 bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. I love the way you walk. And I love the way you talk.
When the revolution starts right now. Here's Mike Malone.
You knocks me out.
10 before the hour, we'll have that letter or a link to that letter posted at MikeMalloy.com. Within the hour. I guess you have noticed, I certainly have, and I'm not surprised, and neither are you, and blah, 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 blah. But the total, and I mean total, a few mentions by a couple of half-wits in the middle of the afternoon on CNN is not coverage, but the total blackout provided by CNN, Fox, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, and NBC, where it concerns the thousands of protesters across the country on the so-called U.S. Day of Rage. Hundreds of people flooding into Manhattan and other cities to take part in these events around the country. The objective is to, quote, nonviolently disrupt the disloyal, incompetent, and corrupt special interests which have usurped our nation's civil and military power, spawning a host of threats to our liberty, lives, and national security, end quote. The three cable news networks, so-called, have devoted zero, zip, to this story. I mean, they really haven't. This is so expected. We have a link at our website to some of the video recorded today of the arrests in Lower Manhattan in the rain. And to see the young people once again resisting was something that mattered a lot to me. I don't know how you feel about it, but and no coverage, none whatsoever, nothing. And again, it's to be expected. Corporate media in this country is nothing if not a complete abject failure. And the fact that the few progressives that are on these cable networks, who either choose to ignore what's going on in Lower Manhattan or are instructed not to cover it. Either way, is very discouraging, depressing. Why it's not being covered, I think, is clearly evident in the fact that why would corporate news organizations cover a protest against corporate power? The corporate news organizations display this power 24/7. The power to, first, make people forget, but secondly, to promote this whole corporatist idea. I mean, you've seen it in Bush's and Obama's, Bush 1 and Bush 2 and Obama's wars, especially Bush 1 and Bush 2, not so in Obama's continuing the Bush murder policies. But Bush 1 and Bush 2, remember all that? Remember the yellow ribbons? Remember, it was just, I mean, branding. MSNBC, Fox, CNN tried to brand these wars as our war. No, it's our war. No, we got better ratings. You did. No, we got better ratings. No, we got more coverage. No, we got more coverage. That's news media. That's the television news media. And as Kay pointed out at the beginning of the program tonight, if 500 teabaggers got together in Lower Manhattan around Wall Street and started protesting Wall Street policies, media would be on that like white on rice. But because these are progressives or liberals or whatever you want to call them, people demonstrating in favor of limiting, if not ending, corporate power over our military, over our education system, over our system of self-governance, no coverage. A complete blackout. The corporate cable news media, with the exception of a couple of programs, pretty much ignored Wisconsin. And now they're ignoring the protests of regular Americans who want their democracy back in their own hands. And unlike, how many times have you had to watch these crappy ass bogus teabagger operations, with full video coverage? And unlike them, the Occupy Wall Street protest features people of all ages, all colors, all shapes, all sizes, all political affiliations. These people are protesting a broken system. They're protesting a loss of freedom. They're protesting inequality, and they're fighting for the rights of all Americans. Is that what the teabaggers are doing? Right. Oh, my God. Oh, I just glanced up. Oh, my God. It's Chaz Bono yet again on Dancing with the Stars. Whose program is he on now? Oh, it's on that program on MSNBC, I see. So there's Chaz Bono. Again, how many times have you seen old Chaz Bono dancing with the crazy-looking blonde on... oh, Jesus, never mind. You'll see it a lot more, too. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour. I've just got to include this, the latest from this crazed, egomaniacal freak on Fox, Bill O'Reilly. A lot of these folks are just not worth really talking about any longer, because there are serious issues. They are the ones who have stirred up so much that is putrid in this country. People like O'Reilly and Beck and Limbaugh and Hannity and the rest of these people. They're real America haters down at their very core, at their very center of these people. They also, as I've mentioned many times in this program, what their primary goal is to foment violence in this country. That's what they want. They want to see black against white, gay against straight, Jew against Gentile. This is what they want. This is what they strive toward constantly. But O'Reilly, out of all of them have egos that are just, I don't know, they're just massively toxic and perverted, these people. You know what I'm saying? Oh, my God. O'Reilly now was recently interviewed by Newsweek, and he was promoting his new book. It's fiction. It's an historical thriller about the Lincoln assassination. Ooh, I can't wait to read it. Right. And he told the interviewer at Newsweek that he was almost as powerful as the President of the United States. He said, quote, I have more power than anybody other than the president in the sense that I can get things changed. I don't have to go through the legislative process. I don't have to do any of that. I can just bring it to the people and say, look, this has got to be dealt with. End quote. You're talking about, for example, inspiring people to go out and commit murder? Like you did with the physician? Is that what you're talking about? Are you talking, O'Reilly, you sick son of a bitch, about your power to inspire people who are equally as sick as you are? I have almost as power. I have more power than anybody other than the President of the United States. I'm Bill O'Reilly. Look at me. Jesus God. Where do these swine come from? What kind of parents produces people like this? Like Limbaugh. Like Beck. Like O'Reilly. Seriously. All right. Dr. Tiller is a killer. I want people to go out and think about that. Dr. Tiller the killer. 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 Is that what you're talking about, O'Reilly? My God. Now, interestingly, this is a step down from a statement O'Reilly made about a year ago where he said definitively that I have more power doing what I'm doing than I would have had as if I would have been president. Jesus God. Well, I know what I'd like to do with Bill O'Reilly. Oh, yes. Somebody sent this to me, and I saw this headline, Why Are Some Americans So Shockingly Cruel? And before I could get into the article, I thought, I wonder what this is about. Why are some Americans so shockingly cruel? Because I believe that much of the upper age bracket or brackets in this country definitely fit into that category, shockingly cruel. I really do. I'm not talking about you. And I'm not talking about me. You know who I'm talking about. The guy who wrote this, John Thorpe, it's at Benzinga, B-E-N-Z-I-N-G-A, Benzinga.com. But he states right up front that he's embarrassed, saddened, and disgusted by the behavior and the beliefs of the majority of Americans. You know, this is very similar to what, in tone, in flavor, of what Bob Alexander has written. Why I left the United States. Remember, I read it last week, and it went all over the internet. I don't know how many various websites picked up on. You know, just a piece that he wrote to me, and I read on the air. But John Thorpe cites this report that came out last Tuesday, a week ago today, that showed that the poverty rate in America rose to 15% last year. That means that nearly one in six Americans gets by on less than $11,000 a year, or $22,000 for a family of four. Now, I want you to think about that. $22,000 for a family of four. One in six Americans gets by on less than $11,000 a year, or $22,000 for a family of four. What can you do with $22,000, especially if you're a family of four? And at the same time that that report came out, statistics were provided that show the average CEO, the average, when you take all the CEOs, add them up. No, go ahead, fill in your own punchline if you want to. Take all their compensations and then divide by the number of CEOs, and it comes out to $11.3 million each. One in six Americans gets by on $11,000. The average CEO takes in $11 million. Wow. That is the basis, is it not, for bloody, violent revolution, if the people ever realized what those numbers represent. That's pretty scary. In other words, as John Thorpe points out, you can grab any six people off the street, and the odds are that the average CEO makes 1,000 times as much money as one of them. The other five, the average CEO only makes 400 or 500 times as much as the other five. Now, if that's not an obscenity, what is? And the sick part? The entire Republican Party and portions of the Democratic Party are completely okay with this arrangement. Now, by Democratic Party, Republican Party, we're talking about the legislators or active members of those two parties, elected members of those two parties. How many millionaires and billionaires do we have in the House and the Senate now? That's why anytime I hear them talking about millionaires and billionaires in any way other than absolute adulation, I just have to laugh. I mean, they're talking about themselves. One-sixth of our citizens live below the poverty line. And the calls are for more tax cuts for the wealthy, more benefits for the wealthy, less for the poor. Isn't that disgusting? I mean, do you, like I do, ever feel ashamed that you live in a country where that is the norm? We'll be right back.
Your partner.
yet tonight how much he hates these people. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Why are some Americans so shockingly cruel? Do you ever have that? Do you ever think about that, or do you kind of tuck it away and just say, "No, I don't want to think about that. I'm going to think about those cruel bastards over there in Somalia. I'm going to think about those cruel bastards over there in China. I want to think about those cruel bastards over there in Israel, but I don't want to think about the cruel bastards in this country." Right? You ever have that? Sure, you have. Me too. Yeah, absolutely. But as John Thorpe, writing at Benzinga.com, points out, there's absolutely no reason for anyone, let alone one-sixth of our citizens, to live in abject poverty. Doesn't that make sense? Now, the teabaggers and the right-wingers and these thugs on the right, these swine, the scum, the ones that insist, even though they're making $30,000 a year, they insist someday they're going to have $1 million. So they want any taxes on millionaires. Even though those people would insist that if one-sixth of our citizens live in poverty, it's their own damn fault. Right? And letting people live in poverty is not the only issue where we are an embarrassment. In addition to allowing people to live in this kind of poverty, we are also unbelievably cruel and indifferent toward those same poor people. Not everybody is that way. But look at the pundit class, especially on what passes for talk radio these days, right? Look at the political class, blaming people who are poor and not the system, blaming the people for the condition they're in. How many people have lost their jobs and their homes and everything that they have through absolutely no fault of their own? So many millions of people in this country thought they were playing by the rules, and they were. Getting up, going to work. Working for the man, working for the woman, working for the corporation, working for capitalism, doing a good job until finally the capitalists come by and say, "Oh, by the way, we're moving the factory to Chicago or to China. Goodbye." Wait. No. Goodbye. But I have a mortgage payment. I have medical payments. I have a kid graduating high school next year. I want to send him to college. Goodbye. You don't like it? Eat your bootstraps. I mean, my God. Now, there's another reality, and John Thorpe points it out in his essay here. No one in this world gets ahead without help. You know, this idea, I'm a self-made man or woman. I did this all myself. You know, I grew up in poverty in a tenement, and now I'm a trillionaire. God damn it, I did all myself. No, you didn't, you filthy liar. You had people help you all along the way. Now, wealthy people in general have a natural advantage of a network of family and friends who can push them into the right school, teach them the right values, help them get into jobs where they can succeed, right? So the answer then, according to the right wingers, is you have to pick the right parents. And if you can, the right grandparents. And if you can, the right great-grandparents, the ones who set up the trust funds and provided the wealth back during the robber baron days to begin with. Now, if you can do that, if you can pick the right grandparents, the right parents, you've got a leg up, so to speak. Right? Don't you? Sure you do. Of course you do. Most Americans, and especially poor folk in this country, do not have that advantage. And of course, being the type of society that we've become, we blame them for it. We blame the poor for not being able to pick their parents. We go further, as John Thorpe points out, we demonize them, calling them white trash or ghetto moms. We ignore the problems inherent in trying to raise children on minimum wage, working two or three part-time jobs and juggling childcare. We ignore the kids' natural disadvantage in terms of nutrition and schooling. Then after the kids come out way behind the pack, we blame the kids. We blame their choices. Kids have a choice? Really? I think about my 7-year-old. There are very few things. Oh, she has a choice of whether or not she wants to brush her teeth to the count of 60 or to the count of 90. But other than that, and she may have a choice when she finishes up her bowl of oatmeal in the morning before she goes to school as to whether or not she is going to eat the last 2 or 3 spoonfuls in the bottom of the bowl. But other than that, Kathy and I make the choices for Molly, as most parents make the choices for their kids. So we blame the children, right? The right-wingers blame the kids. We'll be right back.
Right from the left, it's Mike Malloy.
Whoa, 25 before the hour. Why are some Americans so shockingly cruel? And it is more than just a streak, I think, inside Americans. It's more than our Calvinist heritage. It's more. It's more than the Hobbesian statement about life is, what is it, Kathy? Short, brutish, nasty, brutish, and short. It's just, it seems to come in this country from a political point of view, not from a philosophical point of view, but from a political point of view. So we have, I'm quoting liberally from John Thorpe's piece at Benzinga.com, Why Are Some Americans So Shockingly Cruel? Do you realize that we spend more now on prisons, I believe that's the case, than we do on schools, right? We build a prison, we build another one, and another. As Tupac said, it ain't a secret, don't conceal the fact, the penitentiary's packed and it's filled with blacks. Why don't we spend the money on better schools or more teachers or better classrooms or more books or more programs? Why don't we do whatever it takes to make sure that every child in America, rich or poor, white or black, receives the same quality education? Why don't we do that? Why is the movement in this country, to the contrary, away from quality public education and toward making the public schools as vile and filthy as possible? To do what? To drive people into corporate schools? To drive people into religious schools? You know, the psychopath that broadcasts out of Atlanta, Neil Bortz, has been talking about government schools for the past 30 years. You got to wonder what... The great leveler in this society for generation after generation has been our public education system. The basic education system. The idea that an educated population will do much better than one that is not educated. And then once the primary and secondary education is finished, people that want to go on to college have their choice. Public university, private university. But to refer to public education as government schools shows just an absolute lack of understanding and kind of a fascist attitude on the part of the person who says it. But the answer, why don't we spend more money on better schools, more teachers, better classrooms, used to be because, when I say used to be, in the recent past, I'm talking about the last 10 years, has been education is not for everybody. And when that couldn't be forced into reality through neglect, it's being forced to become a truism through the fact that, what is it we talked about the other day? $1 trillion in debt college graduates are facing now, more than even the accumulated or the collective credit card debt of this country. And where are these young people going to find jobs? Mm-hmm. How about health care? Every other civilized country in the world provides universal health care for its citizens. What about only in America would you have a scene like the one that unfolded at the Republican circle jerk a week or so ago? The CNN teabag conspiracy to present a whole panel of presidential, would-be presidential candidates as sane when in fact they're all insane. But there was Wolf Blitzer. There he was. Question as to whether a Republican would let a 30-year-old man die if he didn't have any insurance, if he fell into a coma. And of course, the question was directed to that great libertarian Ron Paul, who was interrupted by cheers in the audience. Let him die! And lots of laughter. And you're tempted to say this is what the Republican Party has become, the party of let him die, but it's beyond the Republican Party. What about capital punishment, like we were talking earlier tonight about Troy Davis? What about capital punishment? Where the state murders somebody in order to teach them that murder is wrong. And capital punishment in this country is not only legal, it's celebrated. Going back to that same toxic, poisonous sideshow of the supposed to be a debate, when Rick Perry was asked about his record-setting number of executions, and including the one where the executor was clearly innocent, the audience at the debate cheered before the question got out. Cheered. They cheered the state-sponsored murder of their fellow citizens. Cheered. And I sit here some nights and wonder why there aren't 10 million people in the streets. Jesus Christ, there's the answer right there. They cheered executions. What about torture? One political party, these filthy, filthy, filthy Republicans support the use of torture. How long till they start torturing peace activists? And then there's the idea of patriotism. Patriotism. You're not patriotic, as the writer here, John Thorpe, points out, you're not patriotic for sending sons and daughters off to die in some desert war. And I might add, those wars are for corporate America. They're not for peace, freedom, justice, equality, love. You're not patriotic for tying a yellow ribbon to your SUV filled to the brim with the very oil those sons and daughters are dying over. You're not patriotic for saluting the flag while trampling every right taken away by the Patriot Act and its subsequent horrors. You're not patriotic for fighting against gay marriage. You're not patriotic for fighting to extend government's reach into the wombs of women everywhere. And you're not patriotic for cheering Rick Perry executing hundreds of people. You're not patriotic for wanting poor people to die without medical care. You're not patriotic for wanting to shut down schools and hospitals to keep the size of government more to your liking. You're not patriotic for seeking to starve the elderly and keep the poor in poverty via tax cuts for billionaires. And you are not patriotic for misquoting the Constitution. John Thorpe closes his piece by saying, I'm proud to be ashamed of you and embarrassed for you that you will be proud I oppose you. Isn't that, how do we get to that point? I just have the questions. You know, there are talk show hosts of the liberal or progressive persuasion who can provide an answer, I guess, an answer of a sort. I'm never satisfied with the answers, though, around the question how we got to the position that we've gotten ourselves to in this country. I'm never satisfied with the answers because, to me, they're illogical. They don't make any sense. They usually have some religious aspect or flavor to these answers. All I have are questions. I don't have any answers. Do you? Especially the question about how we got to this point, politically, economically. I mean, we know what caused it. This rapacious predatory capitalism. This toxic political system that is corrupted with money and now owned outright by the very same capitalist system that throws people on the street because they lost their job and they can't make a house payment. Does that make sense? Does it make sense to evict people, put them on the street, destroy families? You know, I've been saying for 5 years, 10 years, that the most anti-family political system ever invented is capitalism. And when I started saying that 10 years ago, I think I was still in Chicago, I used to get phone calls and letters, actual letters from people that say, you know, you're a communist son of a bitch. You don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea what you're talking about. Really? Well, take a look. I'd like to track down some of those people who 10, 12 years ago said, you don't know what you're talking about, and ask them now, are you satisfied now? Do you believe now that capitalism is the most anti-family political system, economic system ever put together? And a lot of these brain-dead people would say, well, no, Mike, it's not capitalism. It's the people who took advantage of it. You know what I say to that, don't you? Yeah, you're right. Hog snot. We'll be right back.
Don't get us wrong, because we love America. But that's no reason to get hysterical. Now, right here, Northern Zero. Because we ain't waffles. We ain't having it. In a world going out upon the big bite. So much violence, hate, and spite. We're going on all day and night. Two times we fight for no violent fight. Yes. Now how many people must get killed?
Oil families' pockets do get filled.
How many oil families get killed?
Not a damn one, so what's the deal?
For the hour, and I want to recap what I was talking about during the first hour about the case of Troy Davis has lost what appeared to be the last attempt available to him to avoid death by lethal injection here in Georgia tomorrow. The pardons and the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles ruled today. They're the ones that have the final authority. The way the state constitution is set up, the governor of Georgia has no power to stay executions. It was up to the Pardons and Parole Board. Um, He was convicted of killing an off-duty police officer in Savannah, Georgia in 1989. The police officer's name was Mark McPhail. McPhail's widow said, quote, "He, Davis, has had ample time to prove his innocence, and he is not innocent. We have laws in this land so that there is not chaos. We are not killing Troy because we want to. We're trying to execute him because he was punished," end quote. And a law professor at Georgia State University who has reviewed the case and found it too weak to merit the death penalty said, quote, "I don't see any avenue to the avenues to the Supreme Court at this point. There's nothing else apparent." And if you've been watching the news, I don't know how it's played in your area, but the last-ditch effort to spare Troy Davis got a widespread reaction among people who believed that there was too much doubt to execute him. More than 630,000 letters asking the board to stay the execution were delivered by Amnesty International last Friday. And the list of people asking that the Georgia Parole Board offer clemency included President Jimmy Carter, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, members of Congress, death penalty supporters like William Sessions, former FBI director. And last Friday, about 3,000 people gathered at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in the heart of the neighborhood where Martin Luther King Jr. used to preach for a prayer vigil and protest. 3,000 people.
I
don't know what to say. I don't know what to say about this case. Why? This man has been imprisoned for, 20 years, almost 20 years? If you have 7 of the 8 or 9 witnesses, eyewitnesses, who put him at the scene of the crime, if you have 7 of the 9 recant their testimony and say that several of them, what they said was they were forced into it, intimidated into it by the police investigating this murder. If you have that, if you have 0 physical evidence, 0 physical evidence linking Troy Davis to the murder scene. 0. Nothing. Then is it not rational to say, okay, we are going to suspend the death penalty in this case indefinitely? I mean, Troy Davis is not going anywhere. And reopen a full-scale investigation, interview the people who are now recanting their testimony. This happened in Chicago, happened in the state of Illinois so many times where people on death row had been convicted because of the testimony exactly like this. And it turned out that in so many instances, the witnesses had been absolutely tortured. There is a former high-ranking officer in the Chicago Police Department who's now serving time in prison for torturing people, torturing witnesses to get the kind of testimony he wanted to provide to the district attorney to get convictions to send people to the death chamber. I mean, Jesus Christ. The governor of Texas, Rick Perry, is so proud of himself for having executed the man who was convicted of setting a fire that took the lives of his children. And it turns out the man was totally innocent. He's also totally dead. Would you like to be executed by the state where you live knowing that you were innocent? Knowing that you were innocent? Now, as far as Troy Davis is concerned, is there not reasonable doubt here? If 7 of the 9 witnesses who identified him as the killer have recanted, have said, no, wait, look, they're, you know, and no physical evidence. I mean, isn't it logical? I understand. I don't understand. I I try to understand the insistence of the family of Officer McPhail that Troy Davis be executed. Two of his children say they will be at the execution. His daughter, who's 24, her brother, who is 22. And the daughter obviously had to have been a baby when this occurred. The son was 2 years old. I don't know. It's just, I don't know. By the time this program goes on the air tomorrow night, Troy Davis will be executed for a crime that he may not have committed. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.